It's dark in here. I feel so alone. There's a light that somebody just turned on. It opened my eyes. Help me to see how your love really stays with me. How your love really stays with me when shadows fall, everybody leaves. I'm not alone, no, I'll never be. Your love stays. When cold winds blow against my skin, they chill my body, but not my soul within, 'cause I've got a fire. It burns so bright, it'll take me through longest night. How your love really stays with me when shadows fall, everybody leaves. Lord, I'm not alone, no, I'll never be. Your love stays, your love stays, your love stays, oh, in me.
I'm going to start a new series next week. It'll be four sermons in March, and the idea is around fences, how God has given us some boundaries, even from the very beginning, some truths that we can hang our hat on, but those fences are being torn down now. And we're going to talk about keeping those fences where they're at. So next Sunday, we will preach God Still Reigns. The Sunday after that, the Bible still speaks. The Sunday after that, Jesus still saves. And the Sunday after that, heaven is still waiting. So that'll be the four Sundays of March, and I'm looking forward to that. So I had kind of a lag week, and I wanted to talk about something that's been brought to my attention by several people, and it seems like more so in the last few months than in a long time, and that's this subject of forgiveness. Because the people that I've talked to have come to me with wrong conclusions. And I think it's things they were taught in the church. So I decided, you know what, I'm going to come up with an outline and talk about the big lies of forgiveness. And just tell you some lies that have been told about forgiveness that you might even think are biblical, and we'll work our way through those. So let's start this way, though. A dying man named Jim gathered his lawyer, his doctor, his preacher at his bedside, and he handed each of them an envelope containing $25,000. He made each one of them promise that after his death and during his visitation, they would place the three envelopes in his casket. He told them he wanted enough money to enjoy the next life because he believed you could take it with you. A week later, he died. At the visitation, the lawyer, the doctor, the preacher all slipped their envelopes in the casket of their dear friend and bid him farewell. Several months later, those three were together, and the preacher said, "Boys, I have to confess. There was only $10,000 in my envelope because I couldn't see wasting all that money, so I had $15,000 of it sent to a mission in South Africa." Well, the doctor said, "Okay, well, I'll confess too." He said, "Boys, there was only $8,000 in my envelope. I put in Jim's casket. He said, I couldn't see just wasting all that money, so I donated $17,000 to medical research. I hope you can forgive me. Well, the lawyer became enraged, and he said, I can't believe you guys. He said, Jim trusted us to honor his request. He said, I guess I'm the only one who kept his promise to our dying friend. Shame on you boys. He said, I want both of you to know the envelope I put in his casket contained the full amount. He said, my envelope contained my personal check for the entire $25,000. Can we have a frank discussion this morning on the subject of forgiveness? Jimmy preached on this a year ago, but I think we need to hear it more often. And I'll tell you why I believe we need to preach about it. Because of how sensitive we have become as a people. I mentioned this last week. I would label the last 2 or 3 years as the most opportune time in the history of our country to be offended. If you ever wanted to be offended about anything, now is your time. Because it's what everyone's doing. We've taught our kids the way to get anything you want is to start every sentence with these two words. I'm offended. And they're learning. I started to tell a Kentuckian joke to a group of guys once, and one of them said, hey, I'm a Kentuckian, and that joke offends me. Fair enough. I don't want to stereotype anybody. So I swapped out the word Kentuckian for goober, started the joke over. Guess what? Same guy got offended. Now, through the years, I have been blessed to receive cards and letters from the church that I've shared with you all because they're positive. Not all of them are. All right? So let me let you come into my world for a minute. These are frequent. Dear preacher, I feel compelled to tell you your outfit does not belong in the... Wait, no, that's next month's letter. I'm sorry. Let's start over. I feel compelled to write to you and share some thoughts regarding the growth of your church. Anyone can whip up a crowd, especially if they do it through entertainment and stealing people away from other churches. I do not believe the pulpit is a place for humor and funny stories. I do believe if people are coming to you from other churches, you should instruct them to go back. I was there when a member of your church was asked by a friend of mine why they attend there, and your member's answer was, because it's fun to go to church. What kind of answer is that? Shouldn't the answer be more spiritual than that? Shouldn't the answer include learning about the Word of God or helping spiritual growth take place? But no, this person said it was fun to go to church. Just because you're adding people doesn't mean the church is truly growing. It's an illusion. And what's going to become of your church, preacher, when it's no longer fun to be there? Well, my answer to the last part of that is, then we'll be just like your church. No, that's what I thought. I would have written a reply, but there's two things that kept me from it. First of all, I didn't know who to reply to because it was anonymous. And secondly, I didn't reply because I don't know how to spell. Let me share a lesson with you this morning that I learned at an early age, and this has served me well. Being offended is inevitable, but living offended is a choice. People won't say that it's a choice because they act as if their being offended is something that can't be helped. I'll give you a perfect example, and this really got my attention. On January 2nd, I sat down that night to watch my Cincinnati Bengals take on the Buffalo Bills. Big game against two of the best teams last year in football. Highly anticipated. About halfway through the first quarter, there was an injury to the safety of the Buffalo Bills. His name was Damar Hamlin. They cut to a commercial, and when they came back to the game, it was obvious this wasn't a typical injury. I mean, Damar Hamlin had collapsed. His heart stopped beating right there on the field at Paycor Stadium. The cameras caught the shocked looks of players. Players were crying. They just couldn't handle what they were seeing. Now, here we are on the backside of that event a couple months later, and he's making good progress. Damar Hamlin, if you listen to him, he'll play football again, which is amazing. But prayer was the word most often used that night on TV. I really couldn't believe I was watching ESPN or whatever channel the Monday night, I think it was ESPN, all the prayer talk. I mean, it got my attention. It's like, wow. And then Dan Orlovsky, who used to be quarterback in the NFL, on ESPN said this, and it really, really got my attention. Check this out from ESPN.
Football gave me everything. You know, and I think even through the midst of absolute tragedy last night, I think you saw some of the beauty of football as well, that it's brought us all here together. You know, like, this is a little bit different. I've heard it all day, like, thoughts and prayers. And you just heard Scherf and Jonathan Allen say, like, all we can do is pray for him. And I've heard the Buffalo Bills organization say that we believe in prayer. And maybe this is not the right thing to do, but it's just on my heart that I want to pray for
it him. Is.
Damar Hamlin right now. I'm going to do it out loud. I'm going to close my eyes. I'm going to bow my head, and I'm just going to pray for him. God, we come to you in these moments that we don't understand, that are hard, because we believe that you're God, and coming to you and praying to you has impact. We're sad. We're angry. And we want answers, but some things are unanswerable. We just want to pray. Truly come to you and pray for strength for Damar, for healing for Damar, for comfort for Damar, to be with his family, to give them peace. If we didn't believe that prayer didn't work, we wouldn't ask this of you, God. I believe in prayer. We believe in prayer. We lift up Damar Hamlin's name in your name. Amen.
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 It's beautiful.
Respect to you.
I like you, appreciated that, but I waited, and I looked for it, and I thought, well, how long before the woke mob goes crazy about this prayer? Never happened. It never happened. There wasn't one person that had a negative response to a national prayer on ESPN. So where was the woke mob? I thought we had cast prayer out of the public arena. What do you make of that? I guess when life hangs in the balance, our culture can't help it. We suddenly and collectively acknowledge the authority of the living God. There was no noisy backlash to his prayer because being offended is a choice. And they chose in this instance not to be offended. Which means if they chose in this instance not to be offended, they could choose in every instance to not be offended. Listen, being hurt is called life. Holding on to your hurt is a choice. And here's the thing about hurt. If you don't get it out with forgiveness, you will act it out in bitterness. See, Jesus commands us to forgive. That ain't for the people who have offended us. That's for us. Because there's no winning in bitterness. I've never met anyone who said, I'm better because I'm bitter. I don't know of anyone who concludes that. Unforgiveness is like drinking rat poison and waiting for the rat to die. Now, I'll be up front with you this morning. There are a lot of dumb things about forgiveness that smart Christians have said through the years. So for an outline, I just want to share with you 6 lies that we have believed about forgiveness, and hopefully this will be helpful. Number one, lie number one, forgiveness is forgetting. Forgiveness includes forgetting. That's a lie. That's a lie. How often do you hear a well-meaning Christian say, forgive and forget? For anyone here who has been deeply wounded, truth is you're never going to forget, are you? You just can't do it. You're not going to forget. There's a verse that people will even point out. All these dear Christians who say forgive and forget will say, what about Jeremiah 31, which, by the way, is talking about God. For I will forgive their sin, and I will remember their sin no more. Let's leave that up for a minute, Rox. For I will forgive their sin, and I will remember their sin no more. Surely, church, you do not believe that God all of a sudden can be forgetful. In his omniscience and knowing everything, that somehow he stops being God when it comes to your sin, and he just can't remember it anymore. That's not what that verse is saying. God does not forget, but he chooses to not remember our sin anymore. And there's a big difference. I've always loved Harold Fortner at the Shady Nook Nursing Home. He told about the night he shared a table with Mary Weingartner, who was a widow who visited a resident now at the facility. And Harold figured neither of them had lots of years left. Check this out. He thought she was beautiful. He didn't want to waste any time. This was the second time he ever talked to her. And he said, you're so beautiful. Would you marry me? At the nursing home. And she paused. And then she said, Yeah, I will. Well, the meal ended, and each of them went to their own rooms, and the next morning, old Harold remembered asking Mary if she would marry him, but he couldn't remember what she said. Well, that's a problem. And as hard as he tried to remember, he couldn't, so he reluctantly called her room. She answered. He said, "Mary, it's Harold. I remember sitting with you at supper, and it was great, and then I asked you to marry me. Did you say yes, or did you say no? I can't remember." He was thrilled when Mary told him, "I said yes, Harold, and I will, and I meant it with all my heart." And then Mary said, "I'm so glad you called, because I remembered saying yes, but I couldn't remember who asked me." The theology of Jeremiah 31, the divine qualities of God make it impossible for him to forget anything. You realize that, I hope. So what he's saying is, God chooses not to relate to you on the basis of your sin any longer. So you can choose not to stew about it. You can choose not to spend the rest of your whole life reacting to something that happened years ago. You can choose not to relate to a person on the basis of what they did against you. You can make those choices. Choose not to let that have a negative bearing on your life. Forgiveness is not forgetting. You can't forget. Someone tells you you can, they're just wrong. It's a lie. Number two, forgiveness is waiting for an apology. That's a lie. I can't tell you through the years how many times somebody's told me, "Preacher, if they will apologize, then I'll forgive them." Well, okay. There are some people who are stubborn enough to take it to their grave, they ain't ever going to apologize. Let's face the fact, we all know people in our lives who can drive us absolutely nuts, right? Raise your hand if you know somebody in your life that can drive you absolutely nuts. Raise your hand if they're sitting nearby. Stop pointing, okay? I had the kindest old lady once, Thelma Goddard. I can't believe it came out of her mouth. She was in her 80s already. She told me, "Mark, sometimes the first step to forgiveness is understanding the other person is a complete idiot." Do not tie your responsibility to someone's refusal to do the right thing. Don't do that. That's a bad approach for a believer to take. All of us have people in our lives who know how to push our buttons. It's going to happen. And I need to let you know this morning, in case you wondered, according to the Bible, killing them is not an option, all right? Calling them names is not an option. Sweeping it under the rug won't work. The answer is to develop an attitude of forgiveness and move on, whether they apologize or not. What was the first thing that Jesus said when he was nailed to the cross? He spoke 7 times. What did he say the first time? "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing." Well, when I read that, I want to say, yeah, they did. What do you mean they didn't know what they were doing? I feel like they knew what they were doing. They knew they were driving nails in his feet and hands. They knew that they were raising him on a cross. They knew what they were doing. They knew they beat him and put that crown of thorns down on his head. So what's Jesus' point when he says this? They didn't truly understand who he was and why he had come, or the scope of God's plan. And if they did, they would have never crucified him. It's possible to do wrong and simply not know or weigh the cost of it. And a lot of times when people have criticized me or been mean to me or done something to me that I wish they hadn't done, I realize they probably really don't know what they're doing. They don't know the hurt that this brings. They don't know what this is doing. Forgiveness is not forgetting. Forgiveness is not waiting for an apology. Lie number three, forgiveness is ceasing to feel pain. That's a lie. That's a lie, isn't it? Some of us have been hurt, and we're going to stay hurt. It doesn't mean you haven't forgiven. It's just not true. I love Revelation 21:4, "And I will wipe away every tear from their eyes." It's a reference to our future home with the Lord. But what he says here not only speaks to the fact that he will wipe away every tear there, what it means is we're going to continue to have tears while we're here, right? Let me give you the MAF version of that verse, the Mark Allen Fugate Bible, all right? I do not recommend you read this. That verse would read this way. We're going to be crying all the way to Jesus. as long as we're here, we're going to be crying all the way to Jesus because the hurt will not go away even when you've forgiven. Lie number four, forgiveness is a one-time event. That's a lie. That's a lie. Look at Psalm 51. I love what David wrote in Psalm 51. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. Let's talk about a clean heart for a minute. In 1818, Ignaz Semmelweis was born into a world of dying women. He was born in Hungary in 1818 and became a doctor and a scientist. The finest hospitals in the day lost 1 out of 6 mothers to something they called childbed fever. 1 out of 6. A doctor's daily routine began in the dissecting room where he performed autopsies, and from there the doctors would make their way to the hospital where they examined expectant mothers without ever washing their hands. Autopsies to births. So Dr. Semmelweis was the first man in history to associate those examinations with infections and death. He spent most of his life lecturing and debating his colleagues who did not think he had a clue. Here's one of his most well-known arguments. Fever is clearly brought on by decomposed material conveyed to a wound. I have shown how it can be prevented. I have proved all that I have said, but while we talk, 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 gentlemen, women are dying. I am not asking anything world-shaking. I simply offer 3 words that will save countless lives. Wash your hands. After much ridicule, Semmelweis's doctrine was fully accepted by the medical community. Even Joseph Lister, the father of modern antisepsis, acknowledged Semmelweis was a lifesaver. In 2018, it took that long, they unveiled a statue to the great doctor where he's rolling up his sleeves so that he can wash his hands. So let's talk about washing our hearts. Create in me a clean heart, O God. We collect dirt every day, don't we? And sometimes that dirt shows up in the form of old feelings. I see it with people. They've tried to move on from it. It's still there. They have to fight it off yet again, especially in this area of forgiveness. Well, I want you to know that's okay. That's natural, and God understands because forgiveness is not a one-time event. It's a lie. Lie number five, forgiveness is trusting. No, it ain't. No, it ain't. There are consequences to every action we take, right? If my uncle abuses the grandchildren, my uncle's not going to watch the grandchildren again. I'm going to be able to forgive him. You may wrestle with that, but I am. I'm not going to let him watch the kids. Forgiveness and trust are not the same thing. I can forgive. I can't trust. Now, I will confess to you that my default mode with people is always to trust. I get criticized for that. And have I been taken advantage of? Of course I have. Have I gotten the raw deal sometimes? Sure. But that's okay. Whoever taught that forgiveness means trust is automatically restored doesn't understand the difficult nature of trust. We're taught in the book of Proverbs, trust is slowly gained. It takes a while, but it's quickly lost. It takes no time at all. And forgiveness does not mean you automatically go back to trusting someone. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. It's a lie. Trust is gained in drops, and it's lost in buckets. You're not automatically going to trust someone that you forgive. But it's a lie to say forgiveness is trusting. Number six, forgiveness is reconciliation. That's a lie. That ain't true. Here's a formula, and it's biblical. It takes one person to repent, it takes one person to forgive, but it takes two to reconcile. And some people are never going to admit that what they did was wrong, and they're never going to reconcile with you, and that's okay. You can forgive. You don't have to have a relationship with them. You don't. This is why Paul wrote in Romans 12:18, this is highlighted in 3 different colors in my Bible. If it's possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Again, the MAF version that I do not recommend to you would interpret that verse this way. You can't stop someone from being a jerk. As far as it depends on you, live at peace with all people. So our goal cannot be to please everyone, right? Have you learned that by now? Boy, as a preacher, I have. The fact that we have this service and not just one big one that includes the stuff we did in the early service, is offensive to some people. They're hurt by that. It's the truth. The fact that I tell one joke in this sermon obviously is offensive to someone. The fact that I wore candy striped pants to preach after IU whipped Purdue. It's offensive. Man, I got in the wrong occupation. If my goal in life was to please everybody, I think I could have done better as a plumber. There's only one person that we really need to please, right? And that's God. My dad used to tell this story. He always butchered it, but I got the point. There was a certain village where a man and his son took their donkey to the market to sell it. And they're walking with their donkey, and they hear a group of people here, and the people are talking, and they hear somebody say, "Well, how dumb is that? Somebody could be riding that donkey." Well, the father heard that, so he put his son on the donkey, and down the road they went. Past another group of people, and he can hear somebody in that crowd say, "Well, look at that. That rude kid making that old man walk." So the father took the son off the donkey and got on the donkey himself, and they went on down the road, and they hear some other people saying, "Well, look at there. That mean old man making that little boy walk while he rides the donkey." Well, at that point, he grabbed his son, and they both rode the donkey. He went down the road a little bit, and they heard somebody else say, "Don't they know that that's hard on that poor animal? Both of them riding on that donkey." Well, at this point, they didn't know what to do to please everybody, so they found a long pole, and they tied the donkey's legs to the pole, and they carried the donkey on into town. But as they approached the bridge, one of the donkey's legs came out, and he kicked the man and the boy, and back they went, and the donkey fell in the river, and he died. Moral of the story, you try to please everyone, you will lose your donkey. I almost got to going too quick there. I mean, come on. Paul said, if it's possible, as far as it depends on you. Well, it doesn't always depend on me. It's that great theologian George Burns who said this: happiness is having a loving, caring, close-knit family that lives in another city. Truth is, some people have to be loved from a distance, don't they? It's just a fact. I want you to understand this, because I think we've been convinced about this lie. You're not responsible for how someone else acts, what they do, don't do, how they feel, won't feel. You are responsible for you, which means this: forgiveness doesn't depend on two, it depends on you. So there they are, six lies. Forgiveness includes forgiving. Forgiveness is waiting for an apology. Forgiveness is ceasing to feel pain. Forgiveness is a one-time event. Forgiveness is trusting. Forgiveness is reconciliation. All lies. Every single one of us has this built-in sense of justice. I mean, we do. There's a little bit of all of us who wants to see people get what's coming to them. But I've decided I'm going to leave justice up to the same one I lean on for grace and for mercy. And I have been transparent with you all through the years. I have, about my own shortcomings and failures. I've never tried to cover it up. I've never tried to have this wall between me and you to where I'm the holy one and you're... I've never, ever done anything but been honest about how much I struggle and how often I let God down. But when it comes to this area, I can preach this. My grandparents and parents who modeled for me what it looks like to live without bitterness and grudges and offense. Grandparents and parents who were wounded by people, mean and nasty things they said and would do. But watching my mom and dad handle that, I can't think of one single time in my life, I'm 61, where I saw them pout because they were offended. Not one time in my life. I can't remember one negative word they've ever said about someone who was offending them. Not one time. Not one word. In all these years in ministry, I've learned to model that behavior when it comes to dealing with people. It took me a long time to learn that God's not the enemy of my enemies. Shoot, God's not even the enemy of his enemies. And he's never going to ask me to forgive someone of any more than he's already forgiven me for. I don't know if you've read The Hiding Place or not. Incredible account from Corrie ten Boom. She lived in Holland at the end of the Second War, the beginning of the Second War, and whenever the Nazis occupied Holland, Corrie ten Boom's family would hide Jews. Some close friend reported that to the Nazis. They came, they took Corrie and her family away. Her father was killed in a was assassinated, actually, and then her sister was killed in a concentration camp. Fast forward to 1947, Corrie ten Boom released from Ravensbrück concentration camp, and she goes back to Germany to preach and teach about forgiveness. How about that? I want you to listen to what she said, and we'll close with this. It was at a church in Munich I saw him, a balding, heavy man in a gray coat. People were filing out of the basement where I had just spoken. And my message was that I had come from Holland to defeat a Germany with the message that God forgives. It was the message they most needed to hear and the message I most needed to share. That's when I saw him working his way forward as the others were leaving. When I got a better look before he got to me, I recognized him as the guard from Ravensbrück who had treated me and others so brutally. He extended his hand and said, "That was a fine message. It's really good to know that God's willing to forgive me." I fumbled in my purse rather than taking his hand. He did not remember me because of the thousands of women he tortured, but I would never forget him. I was face to face with my captor and I froze. He said, "You mentioned Ravensbrück. I was a guard there. And while I'm happy to hear that you believe God forgives me, I would like to hear it from your lips." Again, his hand came out. "Will you forgive me?" In my head, I'm thinking, my sister died in that awful place. And does he think he can erase her terrible death just by asking? He stood there with his hand held out, and I wrestled with the most difficult thing I have ever had to do. I thought, "Lord, I can supply the hand, but you're going to have to help me with the feeling." And so woodenly, mechanically, I took his hand. And when I did, an incredible thing happened. The current started in my shoulder, and then it sprang to our joined hands. I don't know what he was feeling, but I know what I was. This healing warmth began to flood my whole being. "I forgive you," I said. And for a long moment, we stood there hand in hand, a former guard and a former prisoner. I had never felt God's love the way I felt that day, and I realized when it comes to true forgiveness, I did not have the power. It was the power of God. I was 17 years old and preaching in a country church when a man who had a grudge against somebody else in the church said to me, and kind of shockingly, because at that point I thought all Christians were perfect, he said, "I'll never forgive so-and-so for what he did." And then he told me what he did. And then he made this statement, and I wrote it down then. I still have it. I was 17, I'm 61. He said, "I'll take this to my grave before I ever forgive him." Not me. I'm not taking anything to my grave because Jesus took it to his grave. It's simple math, church. One cross plus three nails equals forgiveness. And that's no lie.